The History of Spiritualism, Volume 1, with 8 Plates, by Arthur Conan Doyle. Narrated by Graham Dunlop. Edited by Darren Grimes. To Sir Oliver Lodge, FRS, a great leader both in physical and in psychic science. In token of respect, this work is dedicated. Preface. This work has grown from small disconnected chapters into a narrative which covers, in a way, the whole history of the spiritualistic movement. This genesis needs some little explanation. I had written certain studies with no particular ulterior object, save to gain myself, and to pass on to others, a clear view of what seemed to me to be important episodes in the modern spiritual development of the human race. These included the chapters on Swedenborg, on Irving, on A.J. Davis, on the Hydesville incident, on the history of the Fox sisters, on the Eddies, and on the life of D.D. Holm. These were all done before it was suggested to my mind that I had already gone some distance in doing a fuller history of the spiritualistic movement than had hitherto seen the light. A history which would have the advantage of being written from the inside and with intimate personal knowledge of those factors which are characteristic of this modern development. It is indeed curious that this movement, which many of us regard as the most important in the history of the world since the Christ episode, has never had a historian from those who were within it, and who had large personal experience of its development. Mr. Frank Podmore brought together a large number of the facts, and by ignoring those which did not suit his purpose, endeavored to suggest the worthlessness of most of the rest, especially the physical phenomena, which in his view were mainly the result of fraud. There is a history of spiritualism by Mr. McCabe, which turns everything to fraud, and which is itself a misnomer, since the public would buy a book with such a title under the impression that it was a serious record instead of a travesty. There is also a history by J. Arthur Hill, which is written from a strictly psychic research point of view, and is far behind the real provable facts. Then we have modern American spiritualism, a 20 years record, and 19th century miracles, by that great woman and splendid propagandist, Mrs. Emma Harding Britton. But these deal only with phases, though they are exceedingly valuable. Finally, and best of all, there is Man's Survival After Death by the Reverend Charles L. Tweedale. But this is rather a very fine connected exposition of the truth of the cult than a deliberate consecutive history. There are general histories of mysticism, like those of Ennemoser and Howitt, but there is no clean-cut, comprehensive story of the successive developments of this worldwide movement. Just before going to press, a book has appeared by Campbell Holmes, which is a very useful compendium of psychic facts, as its title, The Facts of Psychic Science and Philosophy, implies. But here again, it cannot claim to be a connected history. It was clear that such a work needed a great deal of research, far more than I, in my crowded life, could devote to it. It is true that my time was, in any case, dedicated to it, but the literature is vast, and there were many aspects of the movement which claimed my attention. Under these circumstances, I claimed and obtained the loyal assistance of Mr. W. Leslie Curnow, whose knowledge of the subject and whose industry have proved to be invaluable. He has dug assiduously into that vast quarry. He has separated out the ore from the rubbish, and in every way he has been of the greatest assistance. I had originally expected no more than raw material, but he has occasionally given me the finished article, of which I have gladly availed myself, altering it only to the extent of getting my own personal point of view. I cannot admit too fully the loyal assistance which he has given me, and if I have not conjoined his name with my own upon this title page, it is for reasons which he understands and in which he acquiesces. Arthur Conan Doyle, The Psychic Bookshop, Abbey House, Victoria Street, Southwest. Chapter 1. The Story of Swedenborg. It is impossible to give any date for the early appearances of external intelligent power, of a higher or lower type, impinging upon the affairs of men, Spiritualists are in the habit of taking March 31st, 1848, as the beginning of all psychic things, because their own movement dates from that day. There has, however, been no time in the recorded history of the world when we do not find traces of preternatural interference and a tardy recognition of them from humanity. The only difference between these episodes and the modern movement is that the former might be described as a case of stray wanderers from some further sphere, while the latter bears the sign of a purposeful and organized invasion. But as an invasion might well be preceded by the appearance of pioneers who search out the land, so the spirit influx of recent years was heralded by a number of incidents which might well be traced to the Middle Ages or beyond them. Some term must be fixed for a commencement of the narrative, and perhaps no better one can be found than the story of the great Swedish seer, Emanuel Swedenborg, who has some claim to be the father of our new knowledge of supernal matters. When the first rays of the rising sun of spiritual knowledge fell upon the earth, they illuminated the greatest and highest human mind before they shed their light on lesser men. That mountain peak of mentality was this great religious reformer and clairvoyant medium, as little understood by his own followers as ever the Christ has been. In order to fully understand Swedenborg, one would need to have a Swedenborg brain, and that is not met with once in a century. And yet, by our power of comparison and our experience of facts of which Swedenborg knew nothing, we can realize some part of his life more clearly than he could himself. The object of this study is not to treat the man as a whole, but to endeavor to place him in the general scheme of psychic unfolding treated in his work, from which his own church, in its narrowness, would withhold him. Swedenborg was a contradiction in some ways to our psychic generalizations, for it has been the habit to say that great intellect stands in the way of personal psychic experience. A clean slate is certainly most apt for the writing of a message. Swedenborg's mind was no clean slate, but was crisscrossed with every kind of exact learning which mankind is capable of acquiring. Never was there such a concentration of information. He was primarily a great mining engineer and authority on metallurgy. He was a military engineer who helped to turn the fortunes of one of the many campaigns of Charles XII of Sweden. He was a great authority upon astronomy and physics. The author of learned works upon the tides and the determination of latitude. He was a zoologist and an anatomist. He was a financier and political economist who anticipated the conclusions of Adam Smith. Finally, he was a profound biblical student who had sucked in theology with his mother's milk and lived in the stern evangelical atmosphere of a Lutheran pastor during the most impressionable years of his life. His psychic development, which occurred when he was 55, in no way interfered with his mental activity, and several of his scientific pamphlets were published after that date. With such a mind, it is natural enough that he should be struck by the evidence for extra-mundane powers, which comes in the way of every thoughtful man. But what is not natural is that he should himself be the medium for such powers. There is a sense in which his mentality was actually detrimental and vitiated his results. And there was another in which, too, it was the highest degree useful. To illustrate this, one has to consider the two categories into which his work may be divided. The first is theological. This seems to most people outside the chosen flock a useless and perilous side of his work. On the one hand, he accepts the Bible as being, in a very particular sense, the work of God. Upon the other, he contends that its true meaning is entirely different from its obvious meaning, and that it is he, and only he, who by the help of angels is able to give the true meaning. Such a claim is intolerable. The infallibility of the Pope would be a trifle compared with the infallibility of Swedenborg, if such a position were admitted. The Pope is at least only infallible when giving his verdict on points of doctrine, ex cathedra, with his cardinals around him. Swedenborg's infallibility would be universal and unrestricted. Nor do his explanations in the least commend themselves to one's reason. When, in order to get at the true sense of a God-given message, one has to suppose that a horse signifies intellectual truth, an ass signifies scientific truth, A flame signifies improvement, and so on through countless symbols. We seem to be in a realm of make-believe, which can only be compared with the ciphers which some ingenious critics have detected in the plays of Shakespeare. Not thus does God send his truth into the world. If such a viewer accepted the Swedenborgian creed, could only be the mother of 1,000 heresies, and we should find ourselves back again amid the hair splittings and the syllogisms of the medieval schoolmen. All great and true things are simple and intelligible. Swedenborg's theology is neither simple nor intelligible, and that is its condemnation. When, however, we get behind his tiresome exegesis of the scriptures, where everything means something different from what it obviously means, and we get at some of the general results of his teaching, they are not inharmonious with liberal modern thought or with the teaching which has been received from the other side since spiritual communication became open. Thus, the general proposition that this world is a laboratory of souls, a forcing ground where the material refines out the spiritual, is not to be disputed. He rejects the Trinity in its ordinary sense, but rebuilds it in some extraordinary sense, which would be equally objectionable to a Unitarian. He admits that every system has its divine purpose and that virtue is not confined to Christianity. He agrees with the spiritualist teaching in seeking the true meaning of Christ's life and its power as an example, and he rejects atonement and original sin. He sees the root of all evil in selfishness, yet he admits that a healthy egoism, as Hegel called it, is essential. In sexual matters, his theories are liberal to the verge of laxity. A church he considered an absolute necessity, as if no individual could arrange his own dealings with his Creator. Altogether, it is such a jumble of ideas, poured forth at such length in so many great Latin volumes, and expressed in so obscure a style, that every independent interpreter of it would be liable to found a new religion of his own. Not in that direction does the worth of Swedenborg lie. That worth is really to be found in his psychic powers and in his psychic information, which would have been just as valuable had no word of theology ever come from his pen. It is these powers and that information to which we will now turn. Even as a lad, young Swedenborg had visionary moments, but the extremely practical and energetic manhood which followed submerged the more delicate side of his nature. It came occasionally to the surface, however, all through his life, and several instances have been put on record which showed that he possessed these powers, which are usually called traveling clairvoyance, where the soul appears to leave the body to acquire information at a distance, and to return with news of what is occurring elsewhere. It is a not uncommon attribute of mediums, and can be matched by 1,000 examples among spiritualistic sensitives. But it is rare in people of intellect, and rare also when accompanied by an apparently normal state of the body while the phenomena is proceeding. Thus, in the oft-quoted example of Gothenburg, where the seer observed and reported on a fire in Stockholm, 300 miles away, with perfect accuracy, he was at a dinner party with 16 guests who made valuable witnesses. The story was investigated by no less a person than the philosopher Kant, who was a contemporary. These occasional incidents were, however, merely the signs of latent powers which came to full fruition quite suddenly in London in April of the year 1744. It may be remarked that though the seer was of a good Swedish family and was elevated to the Swedish nobility, it was nonetheless in London that his chief books were published, that his illumination was begun, and finally that he died and was buried. From the day of his first vision, he continued until his death, 27 years later, to be in constant touch with the other world. The same night, the world of spirits, hell, and heaven were convincingly opened to me, where I found many persons of my acquaintance of all conditions. Thereafter, the Lord daily opened my eyes of the Spirit to see in perfect wakefulness what was going on in the other world, and to converse, broad awake, with angels and spirits. In his first vision, Swedenborg speaks of a kind of vapor steaming from the pores of my body. It was a most visible watery vapor and fell downwards to the ground upon the carpet. This is a close description of that ectoplasm which we have found to be the basis of all physical phenomena. The substance has also been called idealplasm, because it takes on an instant any shape with which it is impressed by the spirit. In this case, it changed, according to his account, into vermin, which was said to be a sign from his guardians that they disapproved of his diet, and was accompanied by a clairaudient warning that he must be more careful in that respect. What can the world make of such a narrative? They may say that the man was mad, but his life in the years which followed showed no sign of mental weakness. Or they might say that he lied. But he was a man who was famed for his punctilious veracity. His friend Kuno, a banker of Amsterdam, said of him, "When he gazed upon me with his smiling blue eyes, it was as if the truth itself was speaking from them." Was he then self-deluded and honestly mistaken? We have to face the fact that, in the main, the spiritual observations which he made have been confirmed and extended since his time by innumerable psychic observers. The true verdict is that he was the first, and in many ways the greatest, of the whole line of mediums, that he was subject to the errors as well as to the privileges which mediumship brings, that only by the study of mediumship can his powers be really understood, and that in endeavoring to separate him from spiritualism, his new church has shown a complete misapprehension of his gifts and of their true place in the general scheme of nature. As a great pioneer of the spiritual movement, his position is both intelligible and glorious. As an isolated figure with incomprehensible powers, there is no place for him in any broad comprehensive scheme of religious thought. It is interesting to note that he considered his powers to be intimately connected with a system of respiration, air and ether being all around us. It is as if some men could breathe more ether and less air and so attain a more etheric state. This, no doubt, is a crude and clumsy way of putting it, but some such idea runs through the work of many schools of psychic thought. Lawrence Oliphant, who had no obvious connection with Swedenborg, wrote his book Symptomata in order to explain it. The Indian system of yoga depends upon the same idea. But anyone who has seen an ordinary medium go into trance is aware of the peculiar hissing intakes with which the process begins and the deep expirations with which it ends. A fruitful field of study lies there for the science of the future. Here, as in other psychic matters, caution is needed. The author has known several cases where tragic results have followed upon an ignorant use of deep breathing psychic exercises. Spiritual, like electrical power, has its allotted use, but needs some knowledge and caution in handling. Swedenborg sums up the matter by saying that when he communed with spirits, he would, for an hour at a time, hardly draw a breath, taking in only enough air to serve as a supply to his thoughts. Apart from this peculiarity of respiration, Swedenborg was normal during his visions, though he naturally preferred to be secluded at such times. He seems to have been privileged to examine the other world through several of its spheres, and though his theological habit of mind may have tinctured his descriptions, on the other hand, the vast range of his material knowledge gave him unusual powers of observation and comparison. Let us see what were the main facts which he brought back from his numerous journeys, and how far they coincide with those which have been obtained since his day by psychic methods. He found, then, that the other world, to which we all go to after death, consisted of a number of different spheres representing various shades of luminosity and happiness, each of us going to that which our spiritual condition has fitted us. We are judged in automatic fashion, like going to like by some spiritual law, and the result being determined by the total result of our life, so that absolution or a deathbed repentance can be of little avail. He found in these spheres that the scenery and conditions of this world were closely reproduced. And so also was the general framework of society. He found houses in which families lived, temples in which they worshipped, halls in which they assembled for social purposes, palaces in which rulers might dwell. Death was made easy by the presence of celestial beings who helped the newcomer into his fresh existence. Such newcomers had an immediate period of complete rest. They regained consciousness in a few days of our time. There were both angels and devils, but they were not of another order to ourselves. They were all human beings who had lived on Earth and who were either undeveloped souls as devils or highly developed souls as angels. We did not change in any way at death. Man lost nothing by death, but was still a man in all respects, though more perfect than when in the body. He took with him not only his powers, but also his acquired modes of thought, his beliefs, and his prejudices. All children were received equally, whether baptized or not. They grew up in the other world. Young women mothered them until the real mother came across. There was no eternal punishment. Those who were in the hells could work their way out if they had the impulse. Those in the heavens were also in no permanent place, but were working their way to something higher. There was marriage in the form of spiritual union in the next world. It takes a man and a woman to make a complete human unit. Swedenborg, it may be remarked, was never married in life. There was no detail too small for his observation in the spirit spheres. He speaks of the architecture, the artisan's work, the flowers and fruits, describes the embroidery, the art, the music, the literature, the science, the schools, the museums, the colleges, the libraries, and the sports. It may all shock conventional minds, though why harps, crowns, and thrones should be tolerated and other less material things denied is hard to see. Those who left this world, old, decrepit, diseased, or deformed, renewed their youth and gradually assumed their full vigor. Married couples continued together, if their feelings towards each other were close and sympathetic. If not, the marriage was dissolved. Two real lovers are not separated by the death of one, since the spirit of the deceased dwells with the spirit of the survivor, and this even to the death of the latter, when they again meet and are reunited, and love each other more tenderly than before. Such are some gleanings out of the immense store of information which God sent to the world through Swedenborg. Again and again they have been repeated by the mouths and the pens of our own spiritualistic illuminates. The world has so far disregarded it and clung to outworn and senseless conceptions. Gradually the new knowledge is making its way, however. And when it has been entirely accepted, the true greatness of the mission of Swedenborg will be recognized, while his biblical exegesis will be forgotten. The new church, which was formed in order to sustain the teachings of the Swedish master, has allowed itself to become a backwater instead of keeping its rightful place as the original source of psychic knowledge. When the spiritualistic movement broke out in 1848, and when men like Andrew Jackson Davis supported it with philosophic writings and psychic powers which can hardly be distinguished from those of Swedenborg, the new church would have been well advised to hail this development as being on the lines indicated by their leader. Instead of doing so, they have preferred, for some reason which is difficult to understand, to exaggerate every point of difference and ignore every point of resemblance until the two bodies have drifted into a position of hostility. In point of fact, every spiritualist should honor Swedenborg, and his bust should be in every spiritualist temple, as being the first and greatest of modern mediums. On the other hand, the new church should sink any small differences and join heartily in the new movement, contributing their church and organization to the common cause. It is difficult on examining Swedenborg's life to discover what are the causes which makes his present-day followers look askance at other psychic bodies. What he did then is what they do now. Speaking of Polem's death, the seer says, "He died on Monday and spoke with me on Thursday. I was invited to the funeral. He saw the hearse and saw them let down the coffin into the grave. He conversed with me as it was going on, asking me why they had buried him when he was alive. When the priest pronounced that he would rise again at the day of judgment, he asked why this was when he had risen already. He wondered that such a belief could obtain, considering that he was even now alive. This is entirely in accord with the experience of a present-day medium. If Swedenborg was within his rights, then the medium is so also. Again, Brahe was beheaded at 10 in the morning and spoke to me at 10 that night. He was with me almost without interruption for several days." Such instances show that Swedenborg had no more scruples about converse with the dead than the Christ had when he spoke on the mountain with Moses and Elias. Swedenborg has laid down his own view very clearly. But in considering it, one has to remember the time in which he lived and his want of experience of the trend and object of the new revelation. This view was that God, for good and wise purposes, had separated the world of spirits from ours, and that communication was not granted except for cogent reasons, among which mere curiosity should not be counted. Every earnest student of the psychic would agree with it, and every earnest spiritualist is averse from turning the most solemn thing upon earth into a sort of pastime. As to having a cogent reason, our main reason is that such an age of materialism as Swedenborg can never have imagined, we are endeavoring to prove the existence and supremacy of spirit in so objective a way that it will meet and beat the materialists on their own ground. It would be hard to imagine any reason more cogent than this, and therefore we have every right to claim that if Swedenborg were now living, he would have been a leader in our modern psychic movement. Some of his followers, notably Dr. Garth Wilkinson, have put forward another objection thus. The danger of a man in speaking with spirits is that we are all in association with our likes, and being full of evil, these similar spirits, could we face them, would but confirm us in our own state of views. To this we can only reply that though it is specious, it is proved by experience to be false. Man is not naturally bad. The average human being is good. The mere act of spiritual communication in its solemnity brings out the religious side. Therefore, as a rule, it is not the evil but the good influence which is encountered, as the beautiful and moral records of seances will show. The author can testify that in nearly 40 years of psychic work, during which he has attended innumerable seances in many lands, he has never on any single occasion heard an obscene word or any message which could offend the ears of the most delicate female. Other veteran spiritualists bring the same testimony. Therefore, while it is undoubtedly true that evil spirits are attracted to an evil circle, in actual practice, it is a very rare thing for anyone to be incommoded thereby. When such spirits come to the proper procedure, it is not to repulse them, but rather to reason gently with them, and so endeavor to make them realize their own condition and what they should do for self-improvement. This has occurred many times within the author's personal experience and with the happiest results. Some little personal account of Swedenborg may fitly end this brief review of his doctrines, which is primarily intended to indicate his position in the general scheme. He must have been a most frugal, practical, hard-working, and energetic young man, and a most lovable old one. Life seems to have mellowed him into a very gentle and venerable creature. He was placid, serene, and ever ready for conversation, which did not take a psychic turn unless his companions so desired. The material of such conversations was always remarkable, but he was afflicted with a stammer which hindered his enunciation. In person, he was tall and spare, with a spiritual face, blue eyes, a wig to his shoulders, dark clothing, knee breeches, buckles, and a cane. Swedenborg claimed that a heavy cloud was formed round the earth by the psychic grossness of humanity, and that from time to time there was a judgment and a clearing up, even as the thunderstorm clears the material atmosphere. He saw that the world, even in his day, was drifting into a dangerous position owing to the unreason of the churches on one side and the reaction towards absolute want of religion, which was caused by it. Modern psychic authorities, notably Vale Owen, have spoken of this ever-accumulating cloud, and there's a very general feeling that the necessary cleansing process will not be long postponed. A notice of Swedenborg from the spiritualistic standpoint may be best concluded by an extract from his own diary. He says, "All confirmations in matters pertaining to theology are, as it were, glued fast into the brains, and can with difficulty be removed. And while they remain, genuine truths can find no place." He was a great seer, a great pioneer of psychic knowledge, and his weakness lay in those very words which he has written. The general reader who desires to go further will find Swedenborg's most characteristic teachings in his Heaven and Hell, the New Jerusalem, and Arcana Celestia. His life has been admirably done by Garth Wilkinson, Trowbridge, and Brayley Hodgetts, the present president of the English Swedenborg Society. In spite of all his theological symbolism, his name must live eternally as the first of all modern men who was given a description of the process of death and of the world beyond, which is not founded upon the vague, ecstatic, and impossible visions of the old churches, but which actually corresponds with the descriptions which we ourselves obtain from those who endeavor to convey back to us some clear idea of their new existence. Chapter 2. Edward Irving, the Shakers. The story of Edward Irving and his experience of spiritual manifestations in the years from 1830 to 1833 are of great interest to the psychic student, and help to bridge the gap between Swedenborg on one side and Andrew Jackson Davis on the other. The facts are as follows. Edward Irving was of that hard-working, poorer-class Scottish stock which has produced so many great men. Of the same stock and at the same time and district came Thomas Carlyle. Irving was born in Annan in the year 1792. After a hard, studious youth, he developed into a very singular man. In person, he was a giant and a Hercules in strength, his splendid physique being only marred by a bad outward cast of one eye, a defect which, like Byron's lame foot, seemed in some sort to present an analogy to the extremes in his character. His mind, which was virile, broad, and courageous, was warped by early training in the narrow school of the Scottish Church, where the hard, crude views of the old Covenanters, an impossible Protestantism which represented a reaction against an impossible Catholicism, still poisoned the human soul. His mental position was strangely contradictory, for while he had inherited the cramped theology, he failed to inherit much which is the very birthright of the poorer Scot. He was opposed to all that was liberal, and even such obvious measures of justice as the Reform Bill of 1832 found in him a determined opponent. This strange, eccentric, and formidable man had his proper environment in the 17th century, when his prototypes were holding moorland meetings in Galloway and avoiding, or possibly even attacking with arms of the flesh, the dragoons of Claverhouse. But live when he might, he was bound to write his name in some fashion on the annals of his time. We read of his strenuous youth in Scotland, of his rivalry with his friend Carlyle, and the affections of the clever and vivacious Jane Welsh, of his enormous walks and feats of strength, of his short career as a rather violent schoolteacher at Kirkcaldy, of his marriage to the daughter of a minister in that town, and finally of his becoming curate or assistant to the great Dr. Chalmers, who was at that time the most famous clergyman in Scotland, and whose administration of his parish in Glasgow is one of the outstanding chapters in the history of the Scottish Church. In this capacity, he gained that man-to-man acquaintance with the poorer classes, which is the best and most practical of all preparations for the work of life. Without it, indeed, no man is complete. There was at that time a small Scottish church in Hatton Garden, off Holborn in London, which had lost its pastor and was in poor position, both spiritually and financially. The vacancy was offered to Dr. Chalmers' assistant, and after some heart searchings was accepted by him. Here his sonorous eloquence and his thoroughgoing delivery of the gospel message began to attract attention, and suddenly the strange Scottish giant became the fashion. The humble street was blocked by carriages on Sunday morning, and some of the most distinguished men and women in London scrambled for a share of the very scanty accommodation. There's evidence that this extreme popularity did not last, and possibly the preacher's habit of expounding a text for an hour and a half was too much for the English weakling, however acceptable north of the Tweed. Finally, the move was made to a larger church in Regent Square, which could hold 2,000 people, and there were sufficient stalwarts to fill this in decent fashion, though the preacher had ceased to excite the interest of his earlier days. Apart from his oratory, Irving seems to have been a conscientious and hard-working pastor, striving assiduously for the temporal needs of the more humble of his flock, and ever ready at all hours of the day or night to follow the call of duty. Soon, however, there came a rift between him and the authorities of the church. The matter in dispute made a very fine basis for a theological quarrel of the type which has done more harm in the world than the smallpox. The question was whether the Christ had in him the possibility of sin, or whether the divine portion of his being was a complete and absolute bar to physical temptations. The assessors contended that the association of such ideas as sin and Christ was a blasphemy. The obdurate clergyman, however, replied with some show of reason that unless the Christ had the capacity for sin, and successfully resisted it, his earthly lot was not the same as ours, and his virtues deserved less admiration. The matter was argued out in London with immense seriousness and an intolerable length, with the result that the presbytery declared its unanimous disapproval of the pastor's views. As, however, his congregation in turn expressed their unqualified approval, he was able to disregard the censure of his official brethren. But a greater stumbling block lay ahead, and Irving's encounter with it has made his name live as all names live which associate themselves with real spiritual issues. It should first be understood that Irving was deeply interested in biblical prophecy, especially the vague and terrible images of St. John, and the strangely methodical forecasts of Daniel. He brooded much over the years and the days which were fixed as the allotted time before the days of wrath should precede the second coming of the Lord. There were others at that time, 1830 and onwards, who were deeply immersed in the same somber speculations. Among these was a wealthy banker named Drummond, who had a large country house at Albury, near Guildford. At this house, these biblical students used to assemble from time to time, discussing and comparing their views with such thoroughness that it was not unusual for their sittings to extend over a week, each day being fully taken up from breakfast or supper. This band was called the Albury Prophets. Excited by the political portents which led up to the Reform Bill, they all considered that the foundations of the deep had been loosened. It is hard to imagine what their reaction would have been had they lived to witness the Great War. As it was, they were convinced that the end of all things was at hand, and they looked out eagerly for signs and portents, twisting the vague and sinister words of the prophets into all manner of fantastic interpretations. Finally, above the monotonous horizon of human happenings, there did actually appear a strange manifestation. There had been a legend that the spiritual gifts of earlier days would reassert themselves before the end. And here, apparently, was the forgotten gift of tongues coming back into the experience of mankind. It had begun in 1830 on the western side of Scotland, where the names of the sensitives, Campbell and MacDonald, spoke of that Celtic blood which has always been more alive to spiritual influences than the heavier Teutonic strain. The Albury prophets were much exercised in their minds, and an emissary was sent from Mr. Irving's church to investigate and report. He found that the matter was very real. The people were of good repute, one of them, indeed, a woman whose character could best be described as saintly. The strange tongues in which they both talked broke out at intervals, and the manifestation was accompanied by healing miracles and other signs of power. Clearly, it was no fraud or pretense, but a real influx of some strange force which carried one back to apostolic times. The faithful waited eagerly for further developments. These were not long in coming, and they broke out in Irving's own church. It was in July 1831 that it was rumored that certain members of the congregation had been seized in this strange way in their own homes, and discreet exhibitions were held in the vestry and other secluded places. The pastor and his advisors were much puzzled as to whether a more public demonstration should be tolerated. The matter settled itself, however, after the fashion of affairs of the spirit, and in October of the same year, the prosaic Church of Scotland service was suddenly interrupted by the strange outcry of the possessed. It came so suddenly and with such vehemence, both at the morning and afternoon service, that a panic set in the church. And had it not been for their giant pastor thundering out, "O Lord, still the tumult of the people," a tragedy might have followed. There was also a good deal of hissing and uproar from those who were conservative in their tastes. Altogether, the sensation was a considerable one, and the newspapers of the day were filled with it, though their comments were far from respectful or favorable. The sounds came from both men and women, and consisted in the first instance of unintelligible noises, which were either mere gibberish or some entirely unknown language. Sudden, doleful, and unintelligible sounds, says one witness. There was a force and fullness of sound, said another description, of which the delicate female organs would seem incapable. It burst forth with an astounding and terrible crash, says a third. Many, however, were greatly impressed by these sounds, and among them was Irving himself. There is a power in the voice to thrill the heart and overawe the spirit after a manner which I had never felt. There is a merch and majesty and sustained grandeur of which I have never heard the like. It is likest to one of the simplest and most ancient chants in the cathedral service, in so much that I would have been like to think that these chants, which can be traced as high as Ambrose, are recollections of the inspired utterances of the primitive church. Soon, moreover, intelligible English words were added to the strange outbursts. These usually consisted of ejaculations and prayers, with no obvious sign of any supernormal character, save that they broke out at unseasonable hours and independently of the will of the speaker. In some cases, however, these powers developed until the gifted one was able, while under the influence, to give long harangues, to lay down the law in most dogmatic fashion over points of doctrine, and to issue reproofs which occasionally were turned even into the direction of the long-suffering pastor. There may have been, in fact, there probably was, a true psychic origin to these phenomena. But they had developed in a soil of narrow, bigoted theology, which was bound to bring them to ruin. Even Swedenborg's religious system was too narrow to receive the full undistorted gifts of the Spirit. So one can imagine what they became when contracted with the cramped limits of a Scottish church, where every truth must be shorn or twisted until it corresponds with some fantastic text. The new good wine will not go into old narrow bottles. Had there been fuller revelation, then doubtless other messages would have been received in other fashions, which would have presented the matter in its just proportions, and checked one spiritual gift by others. But there was no development save towards chaos. Some of the teaching received could not be recognized with orthodoxy, and was therefore obviously the devil. Some of the sensitives condemned others as heretics. Voice was raised against voice. Worst of all, some of the chief speakers became convinced themselves that their own speeches were diabolical. Their chief reason seems to have been that they did not accord with their own spiritual convictions, which would seem to some of us rather an indication that they were angelic. They entered also upon the slippery path of prophecy, and were abashed when their own prophecies did not materialize. Some of the statements which came through these sensitives, and which shocked their religious sensibilities, might seem to deserve serious consideration by a more enlightened generation. Thus, one of these Bible worshippers is recorded as saying, concerning the Bible Society, that it was the curse going through the land, quenching the Spirit of God by the letter of the Word of God. Right or wrong, such an utterance would seem to be independent of him who uttered it, and it is in close accord with many of the spiritual teachings which we receive today. So long as the letter is regarded as sacred, just so long can anything, even pure materialism, be proved from that volume. One of the chief mouthpieces of the Spirit was certain Robert Baxter, not to be confused with the Baxter who some 30 years later was associated with certain remarkable prophecies. This Robert Baxter seemed to have been a solid, earnest, prosaic citizen, who viewed the scriptures much as a lawyer views a legal document, with an exact valuation of every phrase, especially of such phrases as fitted into his own hereditary scheme of religion. He was an honest man with a restless conscience, which continually worked him over the smaller details, while leaving him quite unperturbed as to the broad platform upon which his beliefs were constructed. This man was powerfully affected by the influx of spirit. To use his own phrase, his mouth was opened in power. According to him, January 14, 1832, was the beginning of those mystical 1260 days which were to precede the second coming and the end of the world. Such a prediction must have been particularly sympathetic to Irving with his millennial dreams. But long before the days were fulfilled, Irving was in his grave, and Baxter had forsworn those voices which had, in this instant at least, deceived him. Baxter has written a pamphlet with the portentous title, Narrative of Facts, characterizing the supernatural manifestations in members of Mr. Irving's congregation and other individuals in England and Scotland and formerly in the writer himself. Spiritual truth could no more come through such a mind than white light could come through a prism. And yet, in this account, he has to admit the occurrence of many things which seem clearly preternatural, mixed up with much that is questionable, and some things which are demonstrably false. The object of the pamphlet is mainly to forswear his evil and invisible guides, so that he may return to the safe, if flattish, bosom of the Scottish Church. It is noticeable, however, that a second member of Irving's congregation wrote an answering pamphlet, with an even longer title, which showed that Baxter was right, so long as he was prompted by the Spirit, and wrong in his satanic inferences. This pamphlet is interesting as containing letters from various people who possessed the gift of tongues, showing that they were earnest-minded folk who were incapable of any conscious deception. What is an impartial psychic student who is familiar with more modern phases to say to this development? Personally, it seems to the author to have been a true psychic influx, blanketed and smothered by a petty sectarian theology of the letter-perfect description for which the Pharisees were reproved. If he may venture his individual opinion, it is that the perfect recipient of spiritual teaching is the earnest man who has worked his way through all the orthodox creeds, and whose mind, eager and receptive, is a blank surface ready to register a new impression exactly as received. He becomes the true child and pupil of other world teaching, and all other types of spiritualist appear to be compromises. This does not alter the fact that personal nobility of character may make the honest compriser a far higher type than the pure spiritualist, but it applies only to the actual philosophy. The field of spiritualism is infinitely broad, and on it every variety of Christian, as well as the Muslim, the Hindu, or the Parsi, can dwell in brotherhood. But a mere acceptance of spirit, return, and communion is not enough. Many savages have that. We need a moral code as well, and whether we regard Christ as a benevolent teacher or as a divine ambassador, his actual ethical teaching, in one form or another, even if not coupled with his name, is an essential thing for the upliftment of mankind. But always it must be checked by reason and acted upon in the spirit and not according to the letter. This, however, is digression. In the voices of 1831, there are the signs of real psychic power. It is a recognized spiritual law that all psychic manifestations become distorted when seen through the medium of narrow sectarian religion. It is also a law that pompous, inflated persons attract mischievous entities that are the butts of the spirit world, being made game of by the use of large names and by prophecies which makes the prophet ridiculous. Such were the guides who descended upon the flock of Mr. Irving and produced various effects, good or bad, according to the instrument used. The unity of the church, which had been shaken by the previous censure of the presbytery, dissolved under this new trial. There was a large succession, and the building was claimed by the trustees. Irving and the stalwarts who were loyal to him wandered forth in search of new premises, and found them in the hall used by Robert Owen, the socialist, philanthropist, and free thinker, who was destined 20 years later to be one of the pioneer converts to spiritualism. Here, in Gray's Inn Road, Irving rallied the faithful. It cannot be denied that the church, as he organized it, with its angels, its elders, its deacons, its tongues, and its prophecies, was the best reconstruction of a primitive Christian church that has ever been made. If Peter or Paul reincarnated in London, they would be bewildered and possibly horrified by St. Paul's or by Westminster Cathedral. But they would certainly have been in a perfect familiar atmosphere in the gathering over which Irving presided. A wise man recognizes that God may be approached from innumerable angles. The minds of men and the spirit of the times vary in their reaction to the great central cause, and one can only insist upon a broad charity both in oneself and in others. It was in this that Irving seems to have been wanting. It was always by the standard of that which was a sect among sects that he would measure the universe. There were times when he was vaguely conscious of this, and it may be that those wrestlings with Apollyon, of which he complains, even as Bunyan and the Puritans of old used to complain, had a strange explanation. Apollyon was really the spirit of truth, and the inward struggle was not between faith and sin, but was really between the darkness of inherited dogma and the light of inherent and instinctive reason, God-given, and rising forever in revolt against the absurdities of man. But Irving lived very intensely, and the successive crisis through which he had passed had broken him down. These contests with argumentative theologians and with recalcitrant members of his flock may seem trivial things to us when viewed from far off down the vista of years, but to him, with his eager, earnest, storm-torn soul, they were vital and terrible. To the unfettered mind, this sect or that seems a matter of indifference, but to Irving, both from heredity and from education, the Scottish Church was the ark of God, and yet he, its zealous, faithful son, driven by his own conscience, had rushed forth and had found the great gates which contained salvation slammed and barred behind him. He was a branch cut from the tree, and he withered. It is a true simile, and it is more than a simile, for it became an actual physical fact. The giant in the early Middle Age wilted and shrank. His great frame stooped. His cheeks became hollow and wan. His eyes shone with the baleful fever which was consuming him. And so, working to the very end, and with the words, "If I die, I die with the Lord," upon his lips, his soul passed forth into that clearer and more golden light, where the tired brain finds rest and the anxious spirit enters into a peace and assurance which life has never given. Apart from this isolated incident of Irving's church, there was one other psychic manifestation of those days which led more directly to the Hydesville revelation. This was the outbreak of spiritual phenomena among the Shaker communities in the United States, which had received less attention than it deserves. These good people seem to have had affiliations on the other side with the Quakers, and on the other with the refugees from the Cavins, who came to England to escape the persecution of Louis XIV. Even in England, their harmless lives did not screen them from the persecution of the bigots, and they were forced to emigrate to America about the time of the War of Independence. There they founded settlements in various parts, living simple, cleanly lives upon communistic principles, with sobriety and chastity as their watchword. It is not surprising that, as the psychic cloud of other world power slowly settled upon the earth, it should have found its first response with such altruistic communities. In 1837, there were 60 such bodies in existence, and all of them responded in various degrees to the new power. They kept their experiences very strictly to themselves at the time, for, as their elders subsequently explained, they would certainly have been all consigned to Bedlam had they told what had actually occurred. Two books, however, Holy Wisdom and The Sacred Role, which arose from their experiences, appeared afterwards. The phenomena seemed to have begun with the usual warning noises, and to have been followed by the obsession from time to time of nearly all the community. Every man, woman, proved to be open to spirit possession. The invaders only came, however, after asking permission, and at such intervals as did not interfere with the work of the community. The chief visitants were Red Indian spirits who came collectively as a tribe. One or two elders might be in the room below, and there would be a knock at the door, and the Indians would ask whether they might come in. Permission being given, a whole tribe of Indian spirits would troop into the house, and in a few minutes you would hear whoop here and whoop there all over the house. The whoops emanated, of course, from the vocal organs of the Shakers themselves, but while under the Indian control, they would talk Indian among themselves, dance Indian dances, and in all the ways show that they were really possessed by the redskin spirits. One may well ask, why should these North American Aborigines play so large a part not only in the inception, but in the continuance of this movement? There are a few physical mediums in this country, as well as in America, who have not a red Indian guide, whose photograph has not infrequently been obtained by psychic means, still retaining his scalp, locks, and his robes. It is one of the many mysteries which we have still to solve. We can only say for certain, from our own experience, that such spirits are powerful in producing physical phenomena, but that they never present the higher teaching which comes to us either from European or from Oriental spirits. The physical phenomena are still, however, of very great importance, as calling the attention of skeptics to the matter, and therefore the part assigned to the Indians is a very vital one. Men of the rude open-air type seem to spirit life to be especially associated with the crude manifestations of spiritual activity, and it has been repeatedly asserted, although it is hard to say that it could be proved, that their chief organizer was an adventurer who in life was known as Henry Morgan and died as governor of Jamaica, a post to which he had been appointed in the time of Charles II. Such unproved assertions are, it must be admitted, of no value in our present state of knowledge. But they should be put on record as further information that in time shed some new light upon them. John King, which is the spirit name of the alleged Henry Morgan, is a very real being, and there are few spiritualists of experience who have not seen his heavily bearded face and heard his masterful voice. As to the Indians who were his colleagues or his subordinates, one can but hazard the conjecture that they are children of nature who are nearer, perhaps, to the primitive secrets than other more complex races. It may be that their special work is of the nature of an expiation and atonement, an explanation which the author has heard from their lips. These remarks may well seem a digression from the actual experience of the Shakers, but the difficulties raised in the mind of the inquirer arise largely from the number of new facts, without any order or explanation, which he is forced to encounter. His mind had no possible pigeonhole into which they could be fitted. Therefore, the author will endeavor in these pages to provide so far as possible from his own experience, or from that of those whom he can rely, such sidelights as may make the matter more intelligible, and give at least a hint of those laws which lie behind and are as binding upon spirits as upon ourselves. Above all, the inquirer must cast away forever the idea that the discarnate are necessarily wise or powerful entities. They have their individuality and their limitations, even as we have, and these limitations become the more marked when they have to manifest themselves through so foreign a substance as matter. The Shakers had among them a man of outstanding intelligence named F.W. Evans, who gave a very clear and entertaining account of all this matter, which may be sought by the curious in the New York Daily Graphic of November 24, 1874, and has been largely copied into Colonel Olcott's work, People from the Other World. Mr. Evans and his associates, after the first disturbance, physical and mental, caused by this spirit eruption, settled down to study what it really meant. They came to the conclusion that the matter could be divided into three phases. The first phase was the actual proving to the observer that the thing was real. The second phase was one of instruction, as even the humblest spirit can bring information as to his own experience of after-death conditions. The third phase was called the missionary phase, and was the practical application. The Shakers came to the unexpected conclusion that the Indians were there not to teach but to be taught. They proselytized them, therefore, exactly as they would have done in life. A similar experience has occurred since then in very many spiritualistic circles, where humble and lowly spirits have come to be taught that which they should have learned in this world, and true teachers had been available. One may well ask why the higher spirits over there do not supply this want. The answer given to the author upon one notable occasion was, "These people are very much nearer to you than to us. You can reach them where we fail." It is clear that from this that the good Shakers were never in touch with the higher guides. Possibly they did not need guidance, and that their visitors were on a low plane. For 7 years these visitations continued. When the spirits left, they informed their host that they were going, but that presently they would return, and that when they did, so they would pervade the world and enter the palace as well as the cottage. It was just 4 years later that the Rochester knockings broke out. When they did so, Elder Evans and another Shaker visited Rochester and saw the Fox sisters. Their arrival was greeted with great enthusiasm from the unseen forces, who proclaimed that this was indeed the work which had been foretold. One remark of Elder Evans is worth transcribing. When asked, "Do you ever think your experience is much the same as that of the monks and nuns in the Middle Ages?" he did not answer. "Ours were angelic, but these others were diabolical," as would have been said had the situation been reversed. But he replied with fine candor and breadth of mind, "Certainly, that is the proper explanation of them through all the ages. The visions of St. Teresa were spiritualistic visions, just as we have frequently had vouchsafed to the members of our society." When further asked whether magic and necromancy did not belong to the same category, he answered yes. "That is when spiritualism is used for selfish ends. It is clear that there were men living nearly a century ago who were capable of instructing our wise men of today. That very remarkable woman, Mr. Harding Britton, has recorded in her Modern American Spiritualism how she became in close contact with the Shaker community, and was shown by them the records taken at the time of their spiritual visitation. In them it was stated that the new era was to be inaugurated by an extraordinary discovery of material as well as of a spiritual wealth. This is most remarkable prophecy, as it is a matter of history that the gold fields of California were discovered within a very short time of the psychic outburst. A Swedenborg, with his doctrine of correspondences, might perhaps contend that the one was complementary to the other. This episode of the Shaker manifestation is a very distinct link between the Swedenborg pioneer work and the period of Davis and the Fox sisters. We shall now consider the career of the former, which is intimately associated with the rise and progress of the modern psychic movement. Chapter 3. The Prophet of the New Revelation. Andrew Jackson Davis was one of the most remarkable men of whom we have any exact record. Born in 1826 on the banks of the Hudson, his mother was an uneducated woman with a visionary turn which was allied to vulgar superstition, while his father was a drunken worker in leather. He has written the details of his own childhood down in the curious book, The Magic Staff, which brings home us to the primitive and yet forceful life of the American provinces in the first half of last century. The people were rude and uneducated, but their spiritual side was very much alive, and they seemed to have been reaching out continually for some new thing. It was in these country districts of New York, in the space of a few years, that both Mormonism and modern spiritualism were evolved. There never could have been a lad with fewer natural advantages than Davis. He was feeble in body and starved in mind. Outside an occasional school primer, he could only recall one book that he had ever read up to his 16th year. Yet in that poor entity there lurked such spiritual forces that before he was 20, he had written one of the most profound and original books of philosophy ever produced. Could there be a clearer proof that nothing came from himself, and that he was but a conduit pipe through which flowed the knowledge of that vast reservoir which finds such inexplicable outlets? The valor of a Joan of Arc, the sanctity of a Teresa, the wisdom of a Jackson Davis, the supernormal powers of a Daniel Home, all come from the same source. In his later boyhood, Davis's latent psychic powers began to develop. Like Joan, he heard voices in the fields, gentle voices which gave him good advice and comfort. Clairvoyance followed this clairaudience. At the time of his mother's death, he had a striking vision of a lovely home in a land of brightness, which he conjectured to be the place to which his mother had gone. His full capacity was tapped, however, by the chance that a traveling showman who exhibited the wonders of mesmerism came to the village and experimented upon Davis, as well as on many other young rustics who desired to experience the sensation. It was soon found that Davis had very remarkable clairvoyant powers. These were developed not by the peripatetic mesmerist, but by a local tailor named Livingston, who seems to have been a pioneer thinker. He was so intrigued by the wonderful gifts of his subject that he abandoned his prosperous business and devoted his whole time to working with Davis and to use his clairvoyant powers for the diagnosis of disease. Davis had developed the power, common among psychics, of seeing without the eyes, including things which could not be seen in any case by human vision. At first, the gift was used as a sort of amusement in reading the letters or watches of the assembled rustics when his eyes were bandaged. In such cases, all parts of the body can assume the function of sight. And the reason probably is that the etheric or spiritual body, which possesses the same organs as the physical, is wholly or partially disengaged, and that it registers the impression. Since it might assume any posture, or might turn completely round, one would naturally get vision from any angle, and an explanation is furnished of such cases as the author met in the north of England, where Tom Tyrrell, the famous medium, used to walk round a room, admiring the pictures, with the back of his head turned toward the walls on which they were hung. Whether in such cases the etheric eyes see the picture, or whether they see the etheric duplicate of the picture, is one of the many problems which we leave to our descendants. Levingston used Davis at first for medical diagnoses. He described how the human body became transparent to his spirit eyes, which seemed to act from the center of his forehead. Each organ stood out clearly with a spatial radiance of its own, which was dimmed in case of disease. To the orthodox medical mind, with which the author has much sympathy, such powers are suspect as opening a door for quackery. And yet he is bound to admit that all that was said by Davis has been corroborated within his own experience of Melbourne, who described to him the amazement which he felt when his power came suddenly upon him in the street and revealed the anatomy of two persons who were walking in front of him. So well attested are such powers that it has been not unusual for medical men to engage clairvoyants as helpers in diagnosis. Hippocrates says, "The affections suffered by the body, the soul sees with shut eyes." Apparently, then, the ancients knew something of such methods. Davis's ministrations were not confined to those who were in his presence, but his soul or etheric body could be liberated by the magnetic manipulation of his employer, and could be sent forth like a carrier pigeon, with the certainty that it would come home again bearing any desired information. Apart from the humanitarian mission on which it was usually engaged, it would sometimes roam at will. And he has described in wonderful passages how he would see a translucent earth beneath him, with the great veins of mineral beds shining through like masses of molten metal, each with its own fiery radiance. It is notable that at this earlier phase of Davis's psychic experience, he had no memory when he returned from trance of what his impressions had been. They were registered, however, upon his subconscious mind, and at a later date he recalled them all clearly. For the time he was a source of instruction to others but remained ignorant himself. Until then, his development had been on lines which are not uncommon, and which could be matched with the experience of every psychic student. But then there occurred an episode which was entirely novel and which is described in close detail in the autobiography. Put briefly, the facts were these. On the evening of March 6, 1844, Davis was suddenly possessed by some power which led him to fly from the little town of Poughkeepsie, where he lived, and to hurry off in a condition of semi-trance upon a rapid journey. When he regained his clear perceptions, he found himself among wild mountains. And there he claims to have met two venerable men with whom he held intimate and elevating communion, the one upon medicine and the other upon morals. All night he was out, and when he inquired his whereabouts next morning, he was told that he was in the Catskill Mountains, and 40 miles from his home. The whole narrative reads like a subjective experience, a dream or a vision, and one would not hesitate to place it as such, were it not for the details of his reception and the meal he ate upon his return. It is a possible alternative that the flight into the mountains was a reality and the interviews a dream. He claims that he afterwards identified his two mentors as Galen and Swedenborg, which is interesting as being the first contact with the dead which he had ever recognized. The whole episode seems visionary and had no direct bearing upon the lad's remarkable future. He felt higher powers stirring within him, and it was remarked to him that when he was asked profound questions in the mesmeric trance, he always replied, "I will answer that in my book." In his 19th year, he felt that the hour for writing the book had come. The mesmeric influence of Livingston did not for some reason seem suited for this, and a Dr. Lyon was chosen as the new mesmerist. Lyon threw up his practice and went with his singular protege to New York, where they presently called upon the Reverend William Fishbowe to come and act as an amanuensis. The intuitional selection seems to have been justified, for he also at once gave up his work and obeyed the summons. Then, the apparatus being ready, Lyon threw the lad day after day into the magnetic trance, and his utterances were taken down by the faithful secretary. There was no money and no publicity in the matter, and even the most skeptical critic cannot but admit that the occupation and objects of these three men were a wonderful contrast to the money-making material world which surrounded them. They were reaching out to the beyond, and what can man do that is nobler? It is to be understood that a pipe can carry no more than its own diameter permits. The diameter of Davis was very different from that of Swedenborg. Each got knowledge while in an illuminated state, but Swedenborg was the most learned man in Europe, while Davis was as ignorant a young man as could be found in the state of New York. Swedenborg's revelation was perhaps the greater, though more likely to be tinged by his own brain. The revelation of Davis was incomparably the greater miracle. Dr. George Bush, professor of Hebrew in the University of New York, who was one of those present while the trance orations were being taken down, writes, "I can solemnly affirm that I have heard Davis correctly quote the Hebrew language in his lectures and display a knowledge of geology which would have been astonishing in a person of his age, even if he had devoted years to the study. He has discussed, with the most signal ability, the profoundest questions of historical and biblical archaeology, of mythology, of the origin and affinity of language, and the progress of civilization among the different nations of the globe, which would do honor to any scholar of the age, even if, in reaching them, he had the advantage of access to all the libraries in Christendom. Indeed, if he had acquired all the information he gives forth in these lectures, not in the 2 years since he left the shoemaker's bench, but in his whole life, with the most assiduous study, no prodigy of intellect of which the world has ever heard would be for a moment compared with him, yet not a single volume or page has he ever read." Davis has a remarkable pen picture of himself at that moment. He asks us to take stock of his equipment. "The circumference of his head is unusually small," says he. "If size is the measure of power, then this youth's mental capacity is unusually limited. His lungs are weak and unexpanded. He had not dwelt amid refining influences, manners ungentle and awkward. He has not read a book save one. He knows nothing of grammar or the rules of language, nor associated with literary or scientific persons." Such was the lad of 19, from whom there now poured a perfect cataract of words and ideas which are open to the criticism, not of simplicity, but of being too complex and too shrouded in learned terms, although always with a consistent thread of reason and method beneath them. It is very well to talk of the subconscious mind, but this has usually been taken as the appearance of ideas which have been received and then submerged. When, for example, the developed Davis could recall what had happened in his trances during his undeveloped days, that was a clear instance of the emerging of the buried impressions. But it seems an abuse of words to talk of the unconscious mind when we are dealing with something which could never be by normal means have reached any stratum of the mind, whether conscious or not. Such was the beginning of Davis's great psychic revelation, which extended eventually over many books, and is all covered by the name of harmonial philosophy. Of its nature and its place in psychic teaching we shall treat later. In this phase of his life, Davis claims still to have been under the direct influence of the person whom he afterwards identified as Swedenborg, a name quite unfamiliar to him at the time. From time to time, he received a clairaudient summons to go up into the mountain. This mountain was a hill on the farther bank of the Hudson, opposite Poughkeepsie. There on the mountain, he claims that he met and spoke with a venerable figure. There seems to have been none of the details of materialization, and the incident had no analogy in our psychic experience, save indeed, and one speaks with all reverence, when the Christ also went up into a mountain and communed with the forms of Moses and Elias. There the analogy seems complete, Davis does not appear to have been at all a religious man in the ordinary conventional sense, although he was drenched with true spiritual power. His views, as far as one can follow them, were very critical as regards biblical revelation, and to put it at the lowest, he was no believer in literal interpretation. But he was honest, earnest, and venal, anxious to get to the truth and conscious of his responsibility in spreading it. For 2 years, the unconscious Davis continued to dictate his book upon the secrets of nature, while the conscious Davis did a little self-education in New York with occasional restorative visits to Poughkeepsie. He had begun to attract the attention of some serious people, Edgar Allan Poe being one of his visitors. His psychic development went on, and before he reached his 21st year, he had attained a state where he needed no second person to throw him into trance, but could do it for himself. His subconscious memory, too, was at last opened, and he was able to go over the whole long vista of his experiences. It was at this time that he sat by a dying woman and observed every detail of the soul's departure, a wonderful description of which is given in the first volume of the great Harmonia. Although this description has been issued as a separate pamphlet, it is not as well known as it should be, and a short epitome of it may interest the reader. He begins by the consoling reflection that his own soul flights, which were death in everything save duration, had shown him that the experience was interesting and delightful, and that those symptoms which appear to be signs of pain are really the unconscious reflexes of the body, and have no significance. He then tells how, having first thrown himself into what he calls the superior condition, he thus observed the stages from the spiritual side. The material eye can only see what is material, and the spiritual what is spiritual. But as everything would seem to have a spiritual counterpart, the result is the same. Thus, when a spirit comes to us, it is not that it perceives but our etheric bodies, which are, however, duplicates of our real ones. It was this etheric body which Davis saw emerging from its poor outworn envelope of protoplasm, which finally lay empty upon the bed like the shriveled chrysalis when the moth is free. The process began by an extreme concentration in the brain, which became more and more luminous as the extremities became darker. It is probable that man never thinks so clearly, or is so intensely conscious, as he becomes, after all, means of indicating his thoughts have left him. Then the new body begins to emerge, the head disengaging itself first. Soon it has completely freed itself, standing at right angles to the corpse, with its feet near the head, and with some luminous vital band between which corresponds to the umbilical cord. When the cord snaps, a small portion is drawn back into the dead body, and it is this which preserves it from instant putrefaction. As to the etheric body, it takes some little time to adapt itself to its new surroundings, and in this instance it then passes out through the open doors. I saw her pass through the adjoining room, out of the door, and step from the house into the atmosphere. Immediately upon her emergement from the house, she was joined by two friendly spirits from the spiritual country, and after tenderly recognizing and communing with each other, the three, in the most graceful manner, began ascending obliquely through the ethereal envelopment of our globe. They walked so naturally and fraternally together that I could scarcely realize the fact that they trod the air. They seemed to be walking on the side of the glorious but familiar mountain. I continued to gaze upon them until the distance shut them from my view. Such is the vision of death as seen by A.J. Davis, a very different one from the dark horror which has so long obsessed the human imagination. If this be the truth, then we can sympathize with Dr. Hodgson in his exclamation, "I can hardly bear to wait." But is it true? We can only say that there is a great deal of corroborative evidence. Many who have been in the cataleptic condition, or who have been so ill that they have sunk into deep coma, have brought back impressions very consistent with Davis's explanation, though others have returned with their minds completely blank. The author, when at Cincinnati in 1923, was brought into contact with a Mrs. Monk, who had been set down as dead by her doctors, and for an hour or so had experienced a post-mortem existence before some freak of fate restored her to life. She wrote a short account of her experience, in which she had a vivid remembrance of walking out of the room, just as Davis described, and also of the silver thread which continued to unite her living soul to her comatose body. A remarkable case was reported in Light, also March 25, 1922, in which the five daughters of a dying woman, all of them clairvoyant, watched and reported the process of their mother's death. There again, the description of the process was very analogous to that given, and yet there is sufficient difference in this and other accounts to suggest that the sequence of events is not always regulated by the same laws. Another variation of extreme interest is to be found in a drawing done by a child medium, which depicts the soul leaving the body and is described in Mrs. De Morgan's From Matter to Spirit, page 121. This book, with its weighty preface by the celebrated mathematician, Professor De Morgan, is one of the pioneer works of the spiritual movement in Great Britain. When one reflects that it was published in 1863, one's heart grows heavy at the success of those forces of obstruction, reflected so strongly in the press, which have succeeded for so many years in standing between God's message and the human race. The prophetic power of Davis can only be got over by the skeptic if he ignores the record. Before 1856, he prophesied in detail the coming of the motor car and of the typewriter. In his book, The Penetralia, appears the following. Question. Will utilitarianism make any discoveries in other locomotive directions? Yes. Look out about these days for carriages and traveling saloons on country roads. Without horses, without steam, without any visible motive power. Moving with greater speed and far more safety than at present. Carriages will be moved by strange and beautiful and simple admixture of aqueous and atmospheric gases, so easily condensed, so simply ignited, and so imparted by a machine somewhat resembling our engines, as to be entirely concealed and manageable between the forward wheels. These vehicles will prevent many embarrassments now experienced by persons living in thinly populated territories. The first requisite for these land locomotives will be good roads, upon which, with your engine, without your horses, you may travel with great rapidity. These carriages seem to me of uncomplicated construction. He was next asked, do you perceive any plan by which to expedite the art of writing? Yes, I am almost moved to invent an automatic psychographer, that is, an artificial soul writer. It may be constructed something like a piano, one brace or scale of keys to represent the elementary sounds, another and lower tier to represent a combination, and still another for rapid recombination, so that a person, instead of playing a piece of music, may touch off a sermon or a poem. So too this seer, in reply to a query regarding what was then termed atmospheric navigation, felt deeply impressed that the necessary mechanism to transcend the adverse currents of air, so that we may sail as easily and safely and pleasantly as birds, is dependent on a new motive power. This power will come. It will not only move the locomotive on the rail and the carriage on the country road, but the aerial cars also, which will move through the sky from country to country. He predicted the coming of spiritualism in his Principles of Nature, published in 1847, where he says, it is a truth that spirits commune with one another while one is in the body and the other is in the higher spheres. And this, too, when the person in the body is unconscious of the influx, and hence cannot be convinced of the fact. And this truth will ere long present itself in the form of a living demonstration. And the world will hail with delight the ushering in of that era when the interiors of men will be opened, and the spiritual communion will be established, such as is now being enjoyed by the inhabitants of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. In this matter, Davis's teaching was definite, but it must be admitted that, in a good deal of his work, he is indefinite, and that is hard reading. For it is disfigured by the use of long words, and occasionally he even invents a vocabulary of his own. It was, however, on a very high moral and intellectual level, and might be described as an up-to-date Christianity, with Christ's ethics applied to modern problems and entirely freed from all trace of dogma. Documentary religion, as Davis called it, was not, in his opinion, religion at all. The name could only be applied to the personal product of reason and spirituality. Such was the general line of teaching, mixed up with many revelations of nature, which was laid down in the successive books of the Harmonial Philosophy, which succeeded Nature's Divine Revelations, and occupied the next few years of his life. Much of the teaching appeared in a strange paper called the Univoclium, and much was spread by lectures in which he laid before the public the results of his revelations. In his spiritual vision, Davis saw an arrangement of the universe which corresponds closely with that which Swedenborg had already noted, and with that afterwards taught by the spirits and accepted by the spiritualists. He saw a life which resembled that of Earth, a life that may be called the semi-material, with pleasures and pursuits that would appeal to our natures which had been by no means changed by death. He saw study for the studious, congenial tasks for the energetic, art for the artistic, and beauty for the lover of nature, rest for the weary ones. He saw graduated phases of spiritual life, through which one slowly rose to the sublime and the celestial. He carried his magnificent vision onward beyond the present universe, and saw it dissolve once more into the fire mist from which it had been consolidated, and then consolidate once more to form the stage on which a higher evolution could take place, the highest class here starting as the lowest class there. This process he saw renew itself innumerable times, covering trillions of years, and ever working towards refinement and purification. These spheres he pictured as concentric rings around the world, but as he admits that neither time nor space define themselves clearly in his visions, we need not take their geography in too literal a sense. The object of life was to qualify for advancement in this tremendous scheme, and the best method of human advancement was to get away from sin. Not only sins which are usually recognized, but also those sins of bigotry, narrowness, and hardness, which are very especially blemishes not of ephemeral flesh, but of the permanent spirit. For this purpose, the return to simple life, simple beliefs, and the primitive brotherhood was essential. Money, alcohol, lust, violence, and priestcraft, in its narrow sense, were the chief impediments to racial progress. It must be admitted that Davis, so far as one can follow his life, lived up to his own professions. He was a very humble-minded, and yet he was of the stuff that saints are made of. His autobiography extends only to 1857, so that he was little over 30 when he published it, but it gives a very complete and sometimes an involuntary insight into the man. He was very poor, but he was just and charitable. He was very earnest, and yet he was patient in argument and gentle under contradiction. The worst motives were imputed to him, and he records them with a tolerant smile. He gives a full account of his first two marriages, which were as unusual as everything else about him, but which reflect nothing but credit upon him. From the date at which the magic staff finishes, he seemed to have carried on the same life of alternate writing and lecturing, winning more and more the ear of the world, until he died in the year 1910, at the age of 84. The last years of his life he spent as keeper of some small bookstore in Boston. The fact that his Harmonial Philosophy has now passed through some 40 editions in the United States is a proof that the seed which he scattered so assiduously has not fallen upon barren ground. What is of importance to us is the part played by Davis at the commencement of the spiritual revelation. He began to prepare the ground before that revelation occurred. He was clearly destined to be closely associated with it. He was aware of the material demonstration at Hydesville upon the very day when it occurred. From his notes, there is quoted the sentence under the vital date of March 31st, 1848. About day this morning, a warm breathing passed over my face, and I heard a voice, tender and strong, saying, "Brother, the good work has begun. Behold, a living demonstration is born." I was left wondering what could be meant by such a message. It was at the beginning of this mighty movement in which he was to act as prophet. His own powers were themselves supernormal upon the mental side, just as the physical signs were upon the material side. Each supplemented the other. He was, up to the limit of his capacity, the soul of the movement, the one brain which had a clear vision of the message, which was heralded in so novel and strange a way. No man can take the whole message, for it is infinite, and rises ever higher as we come into contact with higher beings, but Davis interpreted it so well for his day and generation that little can be added even now to his conception. He had advanced one step beyond Swedenborg. Though he had not Swedenborg's mental equipment with which to marshal his results, Swedenborg had seen a heaven and hell even as Davis saw it and had described it with fuller detail. Swedenborg did not, however, get a clear vision of the position of the dead and the true nature of the spirit world, with the possibility of return as it was revealed to the American seer. This knowledge came slowly to Davis. His strange interviews with what he described as materialized spirits were exceptional things, and he drew no common conclusions from them. It was later, when he was brought into contact with actual spiritual phenomena, that he was able to see the full meaning of them. This contact was not established at Rochester, but rather at Stratford in Connecticut, where Davis was a witness to the poltergeist phenomena, which broke out in the household of a clergyman, Dr. Phelps, in the early months of 1850. A study of these led him to write a pamphlet, The Philosophy of Spiritual Intercourse, expanded afterwards to a book which contained much which the world has not yet mastered. Some of it, in its wise restraint, may also be commended to some spiritualists. Spiritualism is useful as a living demonstration of a future existence, he says. Spirits have aided me many times, but they do not control either my person or my reason. They can and do perform kindly offices for those on earth, but benefits can only be secured on the condition that we allow them to become our teachers and not our masters, that we accept them as companions, not as gods to be worshipped. Wise words, and a modern restatement of the vital remark of St. Paul that the prophet must not be subject to his own gifts. In order to explain adequately the life of Davis, one has to ascend to supernormal conditions. But even then, there are alternative explanations. When one considers the following undeniable facts: 1. That he claims to have seen and heard the materialized form of Swedenborg before he knew anything of his teachings. 2. That something possessed this ignorant youth which gave him great knowledge. 3. That this knowledge took the same broad sweeping universal lines which were characteristic of Swedenborg. 4. But that they went one step farther, having added just that knowledge of spirit power which Swedenborg may have attained after his death. Considering these 4 points, then, is it not a feasible hypothesis that the power which controlled Davis was actually Swedenborg? It would be well if the estimable but very narrow and limited new church took some possibilities into account. But whether Davis stood alone or whether he was the reflection of one greater than himself, the fact remains that he was a miracle man, the inspired, learned, uneducated apostle of the new dispensation. So permanent has been his influence that the well-known artist and critic, Mr. E. Wake Cook, in his remarkable book Retrogression in Art, harks back to Davis's teaching as the one modern influence which could recast the world. Davis left his mark deep upon spiritualism. Summerland, for example, as a name for the modern paradise, and a whole system of lyceum schools with their ingenious organization are of his devising. As Mr. Baisden Butt has remarked, even today the full and final extent of his influence is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to assess.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.